It's Wednesday, August 20, 2014. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. In 5 seconds, you will experience anarchy. Those are the opening words to the theatrical trailer for this summer's movie known as The Purge: Anarchy. Last summer, the movie was known as The Purge. And taken together, these two movies have now entered American popular culture, even if they were not blockbusters at the box office. And recently, both of these movies have gained attention, especially in cities such as Louisville, Kentucky, because of a cultural phenomenon that appears to have erupted in social media. Last Friday night, many people in Louisville were quite concerned because a teenager sparked a crisis in the city by announcing that there would be a purge in Louisville on Friday night. What is it, you ask? Well, as USA Today explains, the horror movie that was released this summer, that is, The Purge: Anarchy, creates a world in which the government lifts every law for a 12-hour period, making all crimes, including murder, legal, as well as suspending all emergency services. What we're looking at here is a movie that depicts a dystopia, that is, the opposite of a utopia. If a utopia is a perfect world, a dystopia is a perfectly awful, evil, deadly world. And you can't really conceive, in terms of the moral imagination, anything that would be more dark and deadly than the world that is described in either the movie The Purge or The Purge: Anarchy. Anarchy is actually the right word for this, because that is the moral state of the absence of law or legal authority. What's really interesting from all of this is what the movie and the response to the movie and the cultural phenomenon now in social media, what it tells us about the utility of the gift of law. What it tells us about the goodness of the fact that God created us in His image as moral beings, and the goodness of the fact that God has given us the gift of the moral law. Without the moral law, we simply don't have any measure of what is right and wrong. There is no structure of conscience in the universe. There is no moral sense of gravity. There is no restraint upon human evil. The threat in the larger culture that USA Today is writing about, the threat in metropolitan areas from Texas to Colorado to beyond, is that there would be something that would mimic the purge in terms of their own community. Frankly, the actual fear is that some kind of false information sparked on social media will lead some people into the very set of conditions that these movies demonstrate. A murderous and deadly set of conditions in which people operate without any law and society itself breaks down. Where law enforcement is suspended and even crimes up to murder are simply not matters of legal or moral consequence. But of course, the very fact that these movies are gaining popular attention, even some conversation in the larger culture, tells us that these are issues that immediately spark human fears and no little amount of human imagination. It is a part of the human imagination to just wonder what it would be like if we were in a world without legal authority and without the restraint of law. In fact, most people, most human beings at some point in their development have thought that they might even have wished for an escape from the moral law and from the reality of moral responsibility. But the more you think about it, the more dystopian this actually appears to be. The more deadly and dangerous we understand a world would be if law is removed. Of course, Christians, armed with knowledge that is given to us by God's revelation in Scripture, are already warned of the effects, as the Old Testament tells us, when every man does what is right in his own sight. We remember, for instance, the bedlam and state of moral anarchy that God judged in terms of bringing the flood, given the entire Noah narrative its moral sense of meaning. We need to understand that from the biblical perspective, the great fear is not that the law would be given, but that the law might be forgotten, or even that it might be removed. Many Christians, evangelical Christians in particular, are fully aware of the fact that the law is a positive reality, even as we often speak of it in the negative, reminding ourselves, as the Scripture makes abundantly clear, that we are saved by grace and not by the law. As a matter of fact, wherever you find a clear understanding of Reformation doctrine, making the gospel crystal clear, what you find is a clear distinction between grace and law. But we also need to understand that grace can't possibly appear to be grace unless the gift of the law is understood within its context. This is the point that the Apostle Paul makes emphatically in Romans chapter 7, where he himself asks the question, if the law kills me and slays me by its negative judgment, is it then evil? And the Apostle Paul says, by no means, it certainly is not evil. It is God's gift to tell me the accurate diagnosis of my problem, which is that I am a lawbreaker, I am a sinner, and to point me towards the only salvation from that peril, and that is the redemption that is accomplished by the Lord Jesus Christ. In evangelical theology, the law has been spoken of as having at least three uses. One of the uses is to show us our need for the gospel. The other use is to restrain human evil. And the third use is for instruction to godliness and faithfulness in the Christian life. Now, when we look at the gospel, we come to understand what it means to be saved by grace and not of works, not to be saved by the law, and not to confuse the gospel with moralism. Far too many evangelical Christians end up speaking disparagingly of the law in such a way that the movie The Purge actually brings to our attention. The dystopia of The Purge and its successor movie The Purge Anarchy, the fact that you have law enforcement officials and the writers of USA Today concerned that there may be actual attempts to mimic The Purge, all these things are very clear indicators of the goodness of the law and how thankful we should be for the gift of the law. How concerned we should be, as Americans seem now to be intuitively concerned, about what would happen if the law were to be suspended and legal authority were to disappear. And these two movies appear to be dystopian and scary precisely because they are at least indicators of what would happen if the law were removed and if legal authority were to disappear. It's hard to believe that there's much of a serious threat of Americans actually trying to mimic this movie in any wide-scale approach, but one thing is clear. This conversation helps us to understand why the law is such a gift and why the restraining power of the law in human society is so absolutely necessary. If the movies, known as The Purge and The Purge Anarchy, are in any sense entertaining, it is because it is not only fascinating but horrifying to imagine a world in which the law has simply been suspended, in which there is no moral accountability. And even worse, it's possible to conceive a world in which there is no moral conscience. There is no binding sense of moral knowledge that is a source of the restraint against evil that is so necessary in human society. Christians looking at the controversy over these movies need to recognize that a basic theological point is being made, a point that is central to the Christian worldview. The understanding that the world we live in is dangerous enough because of sin and its consequences and God's judgment upon human iniquity. But it would be far worse if God did not love us so much that he gave us, as one of his gifts to humanity, the moral knowledge that is part of being made in his image and the restraint of the law that is given to us in order that we might not kill each other and rob from each other and do everything that would be imaginable, even without the knowledge of the evil that is thereby done. But oddly enough, even as there's a lot of cultural conversation about those two movies, there's even more conversation about a more lasting and troubling issue, and that is what is known as legal marijuana. In this case as well, what we see is a testimony to the necessity of law, not only to the existence of law, but to the law rightly reflecting what leads to human happiness, to human order, and to human flourishing. For instance, looking again to USA Today, a major article appeared on the front page entitled "Colorado Aims to Sell More Legal Pot." This is one of those headlines that even just a couple of years ago would have made no sense whatsoever, but it makes a rather awkward sense now. And as USA Today reports, here's the problem for the state of Colorado. Colorado legalized recreational marijuana and intends not only to make it available, but to make money off of it in terms of revenue to the state. So in order to regulate this newly legalized marijuana trade, it has come up with ways whereby there are authorized growers and authorized distributors in order to sell marijuana to people who would otherwise legally be able to buy it in order that the state may gain some tax revenue. But here's the reality. There aren't enough people growing marijuana through these legal channels for Colorado to get the income that it thinks it needs. Colorado's actually battling now a black market in marijuana, which is the very thing they promised to be eradicated if only legal marijuana were to be made available. But it turns out that there's not enough marijuana being sold through these legal channels for Colorado to get the tax income that it promised itself and its citizens. As Katie Kuntz of USA Today reports, as a result, Colorado state regulators are trying to increase the amount of marijuana produced and sold by legal retailers. Ron Kammerzell, identified as Colorado's deputy senior director for enforcement for the State Department of Revenue, said, "Right now, we are pretty significantly under what should be produced." End quote. Now, remember, this is the Department of Revenue. This is about tax income. Here you have an official of the Colorado government saying, "We're selling marijuana, but we're not selling enough of it. We need to sell more, and in order to sell more, we need to grow more." So what we see here is a parable of what happens when you tamper with the law without understanding the consequences. Some of those consequences were made quite clear in an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal on August the 14th. The writers were William J. Bennett and Robert A. White. Bill Bennett is well known as the first drug czar. He was the first director of the National Drug Control Policy and was so under President George H.W. Bush. Mr. White's an attorney in Princeton, New Jersey. As they write, "Legal pot is a public health menace.
couple of paragraphs in their article make the issue very, very clear. As they write, in the journal Current Addiction Reports, it was found that regular pot use, defined as once a week among teenagers and young adults, led directly to cognitive decline, poor attention and memory, and actually decreased IQ. On August the 9th, that's just a matter of less than 2 weeks ago, the American Psychological Association reported at its annual convention the ramifications of marijuana legalization. And as this article in the Wall Street Journal indicates, Krista Lisdahl, director of the Imaging and Neuropsychology Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, said, quote, it needs to be emphasized that regular cannabis use, which we consider once a week, is not safe and may result in addiction and neurocognitive damage, especially in youth, end quote. Bennett and White then say, here's the truth. The marijuana of today is simply not the same drug it was in the 1960s, 70s, or 80s, much less in the 1930s. It is often at least five times stronger, with the levels of the psychoactive ingredient averaging about 15% in the marijuana dispensaries found in the states that have legalized pot for medicinal, or in the case of Colorado, recreational use. Oftentimes, the level of that chemical known as THC is 20% or higher. That is a radical multiple of the marijuana that was available in the 1960s and the 70s. Bennett and White conclude there are two conversations about marijuana taking place in this country. One, we fear, is based on an obsolete perception of marijuana as a relatively harmless, low THC product. The other takes seriously the science of the new marijuana and its effect on teens whose adulthood will be marred by the irreversible damage of their brains when young. They say supporters of marijuana legalization insist that the times are changing and policy should change too. But they're the ones stuck in the past and charting a dangerous future for too many Americans. But add to those two articles yet another that testifies to the importance of the law and to getting the law right and making sure that the law teaches the right things. Writing on August the 18th in the New York Times, Tara Parker Pope reports that one of the big problems that parents and educators, especially in states where marijuana has been legalized, are now facing is the fact that what they're saying to their kids doesn't match what they're actually saying to themselves, and the kids know it. Tara Parker Pope reports, these are confusing times for middle and high school students who for most of their young lives have been lectured about the perils of substance abuse, particularly marijuana. Now it seems that the adults in their lives have done an about-face, end quote. And that's exactly what has taken place. In state after state, you might say around dinner table after dinner table, parents are now acknowledging that they're using what had previously been illegal and which they are now saying is prohibited for their own children. Tim Ryan, an anti-drug educator who works with middle school and high school students, said about these kids, quote, they are growing up in a generation where marijuana used to be bad and maybe now it's not so bad, end quote. Meanwhile, the New York Times itself has been arguing over the last several weeks for the legalization of marijuana. And in its own reporting, in this story, it indicates the acknowledgement of just how dangerous marijuana use can be for teenagers and adolescents. It turns out that many of today's adults, even parents, are confusing their own children and teenagers about what's right and wrong because, here's the point, they're confusing their own kids over right and wrong because of their contortions with the law. The fact fundamental to both of these stories is very important, having to do with the movies known as The Purge and having to do with the confusion faced by so many people, especially young people, over the issue of marijuana. The Purge movies remind us of how important the law is and what a gift the law is to restrain evil. The law makes civilization possible and makes moral meaning possible. You take away the law and you take away the lawgiver and you have nothing left but moral anarchy. And the story about the legalization of marijuana and these new complications in states like Colorado, well, they point to the fact that it's not only important to have the law, but to get the law right. Because the law is a teacher. It is a profoundly important moral teacher. And when you mess with the law, you mess with the morality. And there are a lot of confused teenagers in Colorado who are trying to figure out the confusion that they have just received from their own parents. Finally, another testimony to moral confusion, this one of an even darker variety. Alan Metcalf, writing in the Lingua Franca column of the Chronicle of Higher Education, tells us what we supposedly have learned in the last several years and what remains to be learned over issues of gender and sexual orientation and all the rest. He writes in the column, quote, it continues to be an education. Back in the late 20th century, we learned, as we had kind of known all along, that people were not simply male or female, but heterosexual or homosexual. The latter we learned to designate as gay as opposed to straight, and then we learned to separate homosexuals by gender as gay or lesbian. So far, so good, end quote. That's a rather powerful paragraph when you consider the fact that what he's stating there is what we learned is exactly what many people in the society around us think we did learn. But he's actually just getting ready to make his big argument. As he continues, but then as we investigated sexuality and gender identity more thoroughly, other types made themselves known. And he says we learned there were bisexuals. He goes on to define that. And then we learned there were transsexuals. He says that gave us four types of exceptions to the older categories of heterosexual male and heterosexual female. By the time he says we reached the early point of the 21st century, we had not only heterosexual males and heterosexual females, but lesbians, gays, bisexuals, transsexuals. So in other words, at that point, the initials LGBT began to make sense. A convenient abbreviation, he says, to help us remember them all. And he says we learned that transgender might be a better term than transsexual. So these are things, he says, we have been learning. But Medcalf's recounting isn't complete, not by a long shot, because as he suggests, we're now learning more and more. What are we learning? Well, he says, for instance, we're learning there are intersex people who are neither male or female. He defines that. That's a separate category of conversation, by the way. And then he says we add to those the asexuals, because even though they're just 1% of the population, and even though they say they don't care about sex, they have to be counted as a new sexual minority as well to be added to the alphabet soup. He then goes on and says, and so putting it all together, we get the abbreviation LGBTQQ2IA. He says not so easy to remember, so someone came up with the alternative, the anagram quilt bag. The definition found in one gay dictionary he cites is this, quote, it stands for queer, questioning, undecided, intersex, lesbian, transgender, transsexual, bisexual, allied, asexual, gay, genderqueer. It is meant, says this definition, to be a more inclusive term than LGBT or GLBT, and to be more pronounceable and memorable than some of the other variations or extensions on the LGBT abbreviation. End quote. And folks, I'm not making this up. Metcalf, who writing in the Chronicle of Higher Education is speaking to the academic community, goes on to explain that the Urban Dictionary has a slightly different interpretation on this, identifying the options as Q for queer and questioning, U for unidentified, I for intersex, L for lesbian, T for transgender or transsexual, B for bisexual, A for asexual, and G for gay or genderqueer. Now keep in mind that here you have an educator writing to the other educators of America about how to remember these things as you think about the expanding alphabet soup. And even as he traces the development from simply heterosexual male and heterosexual female to LGBT and then on to, well, I won't even repeat all the rest, he makes very clear that these options are hardly the last word. He says, as gender studies research continues and discussion proliferates, other variations are likely to emerge. Write that down as an almost certain understatement. He concludes, and this is really important to hear, quote, so young people nowadays have choices to make that they didn't face before. And it's not a once-for-all choice. They can question and redefine themselves at any time. They even need to let others know the pronouns by which they should be addressed. I'll discuss these next week, end quote. So let's stay tuned for that article. Adding to the confusion of that incredible alphabet soup he recited, and yet with a straight face, here you have an educator saying this makes moral sense. And furthermore, you have someone straightforwardly arguing that these are things that we have learned, as if this is some kind of set of objective truths that have been placed before us. But he actually pulls the rug out of his own argument by making very clear this isn't an objective reality at all. This is simply a socially constructed reality in which sex and gender are considered to be endlessly plastic, in which, as he says, young people nowadays have to face choices they didn't face before. Well, those choices are actually forced upon them by these sexual revolutionaries. And then he points to the truly revolutionary character of their assessment when he says, it's not a once-for-all choice. They can question and redefine themselves at any time. That's a recipe for exactly the kind of moral anarchy we began talking about on the program today. And you'll notice that it's not just something depicted in movies. It's not just something discussed by legislators. It's something driven by intellectuals with an ideological agenda. And they make that agenda clear in articles such as this, published in this week's edition of the Chronicle of Higher Education. Keep in mind that all of this is not just about an intellectual debate. It's about a battle for hearts and minds. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.